Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Well, Republicans made some major gains across the country on Tuesday night. They won a special election in Ohio. They swept multiple school board races across the country. Republicans were really energized by things that were going on in schools, whether it was the teaching of critical race theory, as it's what's been alleged, especially when talking about Virginia, which we're going to obviously break down in just a moment. And they did around across the country. They replicated this in several school boards, and also with the implementation of mask mandates and then the fear of vaccine mandates, and also teaching of the LGBTQ curriculum in some states, and that has offended a lot of parents. And a lot of them, they decided to fight back, in their words, and they were able to pull out some school board races. There are also gains in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, believe it or not. You see how close that race was between Governor Murphy and former Republican Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli? Of course, we're going to break that down too in the show. We're going to have a panel on for that, so don't miss it. Stay around. And of course, we're breaking down the Virginia's governor's race there, as there was a big win for Glenn Youngkin, first time around politician and now soon to be governor of the Commonwealth. But here's a story that a lot of people didn't see coming, and we have to talk about this. A truck driver beat Steve Sweeney. Senate President Steve Sweeney has been ousted by political newcomer Edward Durr in District 3. So this is a district that's been going red for a while. We've kind of known about this. We kind of knew Sweeney might be in some trouble down the road. Maybe it was going to be more like a 2023 problem. But nope, Tuesday night, gone, Sweeney out. The voters had enough, apparently, in South Jersey. And Sweeney has not conceded the race as of the moment of the recording of this podcast. But of course, that could change at any moment. But Edward Durr is in shock right now, based on the reporting that's out there and what we've seen. He is definitely humbled and honored to do it, but he's like, oh, what about, I don't really need the celebrity of this. So there's a story right there. There's going to be a new Senate president come January. It's not going to be Steve Sweeney, who's been in charge for a decade now, or over a decade, I should say, of running the state's policy and working with multiple governors across party lines to get things done, deciding what's passing, what's not. And he's the president of the Iron Workers Union, so big, powerful guy. No one ever saw this guy coming. This was on nobody's radar. Nobody was thinking, oh, Steve Sweeney might be in trouble this year. No one polled the district. No money was put down there. In fact, Edward Durr, you want to know how much money he had? Of course, it does kind of sway differently, because what's on the books is he only had a little over $100 on, you know, on cash on hand, and he only spent about $100 on this race overall, actually a little more. But what is agreed upon, Matt, he spent less than $10,000 on this race, and he ousted the second most powerful public official in New Jersey. In New Jersey, this guy did this. No political experience. He's a truck driver. Working class voters. He energized them in a traditionally Democratic county that's been trending red. In Gloucester County, where Sweeney's from. It also has Salem County and another county down there. And he just did it. And narrowly, of course, but he was able to pull that out. Now, we're going to be breaking down this as well, because Republicans across the board did very well in Jersey, despite Jack Cittarelli appearing at the moment not to pull this out, as the race has been called for Governor Murphy. Of course, Cittarelli has not conceded at the moment. That doesn't mean that he ultimately will. We don't know. Will there be a recount at the recording of this podcast? We don't know the answer to that question yet. Cittarelli's words were waiting for every, quote, legal vote to be counted, while Governor Murphy had already given his his victory speech and is already planning out his second term, which is quite historic, as that's never been done in Jersey for a Democratic governor since Brandon Byrne in 1977. And the interesting part of this is Chitterelli, one of the things he was saying on the campaign trails, give me a Republican majority and we'll make it happen. We'll get it done. We'll cut property taxes. We won't put mandates in place. Well, maybe New Jersey voters listen to him. Because if you're looking at these totals right now, yeah, maybe they didn't get that close to a majority. But if you look at it, there are some pickups. I mean, just look at the Steve Sweeney race, so that alone. Look at Chitterelli's old district, District 16. That was only narrowly picked up by Democratic Assemblyman, soon-to-be State Senator Andrew Zwicker. That was only a couple percentage points. Yes, that's a loss, but is that really a safe seat for Zwicker? And also, on the Assembly side, there are only a couple hundred votes between the Democratic Assembly candidates and the Republicans. This is a district that is said to be gone blue and never coming back. This is a little bit of a swing district, but more or less has been written off. But maybe it's not to be written off, as it would narrowly happen. Now, Roy Fineman appears to be in the clear here. He's been projected to win, but the jury's still on that second seat, and we're going to have to keep an eye on that and see how that's all. But again, there's been upsets on both Democrats and Republicans in this election cycle. It appears right now Craig Coughlin's going to be the only one who's coming back to leadership who's been there previously, at least in major leadership, as obviously Tom Kaine's running for Congress right now. John Bramnick's getting a promotion. He's going up to the Senate. He won that race. He won Kaine's old seat. And of course, Senate Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg is retiring and is now going to be replaced. So it's going to be questionable. We don't know who the Senate president's going to be yet. And it's bound to be a drama that's going to really, really take over Trenton the next couple months before the new session really begins with all the new members. You know what's funny is, though, that I actually do know someone who predicted this. He told me this once. It was one professor. It was actually a professor I have quite frequently on the show, Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Ward. And he kept saying to me, Joey, New Jersey's reddening. It's getting redder in the north section and south. And New Jersey's not going to be a Democratic stronghold much longer. I'm like, what are you talking about? That's insane. But he predicted that Republicans would rise up on the local level and that a moderate Republican would come to be governor of the state. Maybe he wasn't too far off on that when he was talking about that, because that narrowly happened. All those things, Republican majorities and a Republican governor. I'm going to have to see if I can get him on the show next week. Maybe we'll talk to him and get some insight on that, because it's really fascinating what happened in all this race. But let's talk about Virginia, because that's the big story here, obviously, that came out of the week. Businessman Glenn Youngkin, he was the Republican candidate. He beat former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe in that gubernatorial race. Now, Terry McAuliffe was a pretty popular governor during his time in office and well known in the state. He was said to be the shoo-in. The Democrats didn't even throw that much money in this race, really, to the bare end. And Youngkin, well, he had a lot of RNC support there, and he knocked it out of the park. Yeah, he didn't win by a large margin. Here's the current margin that we got right now as of the recording time. Youngkin is leading 50.9 to McAuliffe's 48.4. But that almost mirrors what McAuliffe did when he won the first time. When he bucked the trend of the opposite party winning in Virginia in the year after the presidential race. Because typically, if a Democrat's in the White House, then it's a Republican that wins that race. If a Republican's in the White House, then it's a Democrat that wins that race. But this is when Barack Obama just got reelected. McAuliffe was able to pull out a win. And now, Youngkin seems to have restarted this trend of Virginians kind of revolting in a way. Because Biden's approval rating down there is underwater. It's under 50 right now. It's somewhere between 43 and 45 down there, depending on the poll you look at. Now, let's look at why Youngkin really pulled out. Why did Glenn Youngkin resonate, and where did he resonate? Well, the top issues for this race, the top two were the economy and jobs. That was came in at 33%, and education at 24%. Now, let's look at where voters went for people who they said were the top issue. Now, for people who said the economy and jobs was the top issue, they went for Youngkin by about 11 points. Youngkin came in, 55% of those voters went for him, while McAuliffe was at 44%. Education. Why is education a big deal? Because Virginia is the national spotlight of this debate over what is going on in the classroom. Loudoun County, that has been a place of contention there, and it's been on all over Fox News if you've been watching that the last 6 months, where they've been fighting over mask mandates. They were fighting over critical race theory. And then the latest thing is that there was a sexual assault that happened in the bathroom where a boy will put on a skirt, allegedly, I want to put this out as allegedly sexually assaulted a girl in the bathroom. And parents spoke out about it. The dad spoke about it at a school board meeting. He got thrown out because said he was out of order. And also the fact that the DOJ has been tasked with investigating these parents who are going to the school board and have labeled them as domestic terrorists. And based on the polling of this race, a lot of parents did not like being told that. They said, what should the role of your children be? And it went through like a lot, not so much, no, a lot. 55% of voters said parents should have a lot of say in what goes on in that classroom. That's the perspective. Now, Youngkin won this group of people said education was their top issue, 53% to McAuliffe's 47%. So right there, you're getting a sense of this issue is resonating with people. It's energizing conservatives. And you're probably saying, okay, it's just these Trump people. They're all into this thing. You know, let's blow them off. Well, here's the deal. The people that came out in this race resembled a Bush-era coalition. 73% of these voters were white. A majority of them were college-educated. And well, actually, that splits depending on the poll. Some people say it was like 51% non-college white-educated. But the point is, a lot of these voters that are college-educated, white college-educated voters, went for Youngkin. This hasn't happened since Bush. Basically, these people wrote off the Republican Party when Trump came into power. But the school board meetings, if you looked at them very precisely, these were white, rich, college-educated voters coming out and protesting the things they didn't like, what was going on in their schools. And that seems to have come to a head right now. Also, another thing. This isn't just a Republican movement either. No, disaffected Republicans are coming back. The independents also launched Youngkin to victory. Youngkin won this group 54% to Terry McAuliffe's 45%. That's a wide gap. And independents, they're a name of the game in a tight race. And this is, in fact, tight, as you can see. Clearly, if you've been watching television screen and you've been paying attention to this podcast for the last 5 minutes, you will know that independents, if you have them in your back pocket, you are good to go. Now, where did McAuliffe really screw this thing up? And where did Youngkin do really well? Well, the areas I want to focus on is, of course, Northeast Virginia. Now, that Northeast corridor, that north part of Virginia, the Washington, D.C. suburbs, this used to be a traditionally, reliably Republican area. There's a lot of federal workers who work in Washington, D.C., who live in this area. This is a long time. This is why Virginia was a red state, because it had this reliable area. Well, this is now a lot more diverse, and it's a lot more Democratic. Well, two counties I want to focus on, of course, is Loudoun County. Loudoun County, where all this education stuff was going on, how did this play out? Well, here's the thing. McAuliffe got 55% of the vote. You're probably, oh, well, he won this thing, right? So not what we're about. Well, Youngkin came in at 44.5%. I'm going to repeat that. Youngkin came in at 44.5% of this vote. This is a blue county at this point. This should not be that competitive. And the fact that Youngkin was able to pick up enough ground to make a dent in McAuliffe's advantage in Loudoun County, that gave him a boost statewide. Also got to go slightly a little south of that to Prince William County, McAuliffe 56.8% to Youngkin's 42.5%. That's still tighter than in past years. So the fact that Youngkin was able to run it up there too also helped. Does this mean a sign that Republicans are coming back into the fold, maybe, that weren't previously thrilled about Trump, now coming back in? That's a question we're going to have to talk more about as we're going into next year's midterms. Now, here's what we're going to end in the middle of today. As this year's elections wind down, the midterms are just about getting ready to heat up here. One of those candidates is New Jersey 12th District Republican congressional candidate Darius Mayfield. He joins me now. Darius, thank you so much for taking the time for us today. I really appreciate it.
No, absolutely. And congratulations to you, man, on the new home and everything. We're really proud of you, brother. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Darius. I appreciate that. I want to start off by talking about President Biden's trip overseas. He says the Pope told him he's a good Catholic and can continue to receive communion despite being for abortion. Should being pro-choice determine what religious ceremonies one is allowed to participate in?
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to religion, you know, whatever it is your religion believes, whatever, you know, values and morals you follow should probably try and be upheld to, you know, the highest extent always. And I think that's why, you know, we have so many confused people nowadays that, you know, are for one thing or against the other one when they a lot of times directly contradict each other. So to hear the Pope, I mean, I think most Catholics would probably agree. They probably would have just had rather him say nothing in that sense, especially when I just saw that the Pope came out a couple of weeks ago and actually, you know, talked about the importance of not engaging in abortions and things of that sort. So to see and to hear that he said to Joe Biden that he's a great or good, you know, Catholic, even though he's so pro-abortion and, you know, pro-abortion, which is what I like to say instead of pro-choice, is definitely a little bit concerning, but I don't think anybody's surprised with this Pope either. He seemed to have taken a lot of stances that go against the norms of some popes that we've had in the past. And, you know, I think they definitely need to be consistent, and this is probably one of the things that, you know, maybe drive some people away from, you know, religious institutions sometimes. I know, you know, even myself growing up, he always used to look like, you know what, yes, church is a great thing, but then you would see all these people in church, whether it was a pastor, whether it was a deacon, whether it was an usher, or whether it was just a regular member that wasn't necessarily representative of what the pastor was preaching about every Sunday when they were out in the world. So, yes, it was definitely disappointing to hear that he said that, and I think it does turn some people off, and I think religious institutions and religious leaders especially need to really be better advocates for their religions if they want to be taken seriously.
At the G20 summit, President Biden, along with other world leaders, formally endorsed a 15% global minimum tax on corporations. Do you support this tax?
Absolutely not, and I saw that. Now, I will say one of the good things that happened, I know when we first started putting this infrastructure bill together, we were talking about raising the corporate tax here, and from what we see right now, the bipartisan bill does not have that in it, which is a great thing because this is the wrong time. This is definitely the wrong time to be raising taxes on anyone, especially here in the United States, while we have literally governor after governor just, you know, closing our businesses because of these mandates that they're, you know, draconian mandates that they're levying on their small businesses in their states. So, you know, absolutely, I do not support that. And, you know, first of all, it's just so funny to hear stuff like that because we often hear as Republicans that everything we say is just a conspiracy theory, right? We're just saying things because we're looking to just whip up hate and we're just looking to whip up people's emotions. But a lot of times we see a lot of these things start taking place after we've kind of got past that part. And this is just another one of those things where this guy is considering, you know, levying global taxes and doing things with the global community when we are an independent country. We are American citizens. We are the freest country on the face of the earth. So we should not ever be engaging, kind of like what happened with the whole climate Paris Accord, which thank God we got out of that, but we should not be engaging in global taxations of American companies. So absolutely not. I completely, completely disagree with that.
G20 world leaders committed to getting to zero carbon emissions by the middle of the century, but the White House failed to get concrete goals agreed upon by the other countries. You talked about the Paris Climate Accords, how back during the Obama administration, they had that done, while with the Trump administration, they obviously pulled out. What do you think it's the likelihood that we are going to be able to move towards that goal by 2050 with the White House's current efforts?
First of all, with this current president, I don't know how many significant things will actually be able to get done when it's all said and done, because this administration has just been so disastrous and so incompetent in how they approach practically everything at the end of the day. So, you know, one of the things I think, you know, we need to keep focusing on, rather than, again, I go back to even with this global taxation, we need to stop looking to the rest of the world and build upon what makes us great, build upon the things that we already do well. And one of the things we know is that even though the Trump administration got out of the Paris Climate Accord, that the United States maintained the highest level of drops in our emissions. You know, we are a very efficient country. We have lower emissions than practically, we had a bigger drop in our emissions than practically the rest of the world, even after we got out of the Paris Accord. So, you know, as far as this administration's ability to be able to do those things, I don't really think they have the ability, the cognizance, or the intelligence to really do much of anything of significance. So I definitely wouldn't bet on this administration being able to accomplish anything like that. And obviously, the rest of the world probably feels the same way, because as you just said, you know, at the actual summit, they were not able to come away with anything concrete. And I think that's just a continuation of what we're going to see from this administration, whether it's not, even though they own the House and the Senate right now, they can't pass their, you know, reconciliation bills. They can't get the bipartisan infrastructure bill passed because they're just too divisive and they're just too incompetent and in a lot of ways. And I think not only do Americans know that, not only do our leaders here know that, but I think from what you've seen at the G20, that the rest of the world understands that as well.
In regards to climate, a lot of Republicans have said we shouldn't really be focusing on this. The Democrats are just saying, oh, well, this is a bigger issue than it needs to be, and that we should be focusing more on the economy and jobs and things like that. Should we be focusing this heavily on climate change, or do you think we need to be focusing elsewhere?
Absolutely, we need to be focusing elsewhere. I mean, let's take a state like New Jersey. In the last year, because of COVID and vaccine mandates and all this stuff, we lost a third of our actual businesses. So I definitely think they're focusing on the wrong thing, but I also think it's intentionally done. One of the things we had conversations about before this election and right after this election was the fact that we knew Democrats were going to go very, very hard on climate change, because that's their issue right there. That's how they change the climate of America. That's how they change our economy. You know, they've always said they want to intrinsically change this entire nation. They want to change the way we operate. They want to change the way we do business. They want to change what we stand for, and that is their goal. So I'm not surprised that they're going after that, but it's also just a gut punch and a smack in the face to people out here that are losing their jobs, people that are being relieved from their job because they decided not to get a vaccine, even though they may have antibodies, but we didn't look at the nuance of that. So everybody's just losing their jobs. So they're absolutely, absolutely focusing on the wrong things with climate change. But I'm also not surprised that they're doing it because they're also ran by a very, very left-leaning progressive wing right now. As you see, if it comes to, you know, the Build Back Better plan or the infrastructure bill, that is holding the Democratic Party hostage. And, you know, because they let themselves go so far left, it's not going to be much they can do without catering to that base. And one of the biggest things that base cares about is climate change and, you know, just ushering in that new era of, you know, no fossil fuels and everything electric and, you know, things of that sort. So they're definitely focusing on the wrong things. Unfortunately, I don't think they care right now because I also think they know they don't have much time left because Republicans will take the House next year. I'm supremely confident of that. So it'll be interesting to see what they try to jam through and over this next year. But yeah, they're definitely focusing on the wrong thing. And I think it's only going to help Republicans as we move forward.
Now, scientists are warning if we don't do something about climate change that things are going to start changing drastically for the worse in terms of our environment. So should we be trying to do something to either reduce emissions or something to help the environment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as I said before, that America already does. You know, we had the lowest carbon emissions of any country in the world, the biggest drops of these same countries. So I think a lot of this onus needs to be on the rest of the world. And that's what, you know, somebody like Donald Trump was all about, you know, divvying up the responsibility to the people that deserve to have those responsibilities. America is already on track to be more efficient, to get, you know, electric cars on the road. And I know there may be some countries that, you know, are a little bit better as far as the electric car part and, you know, things of that sort, but we've been doing a lot. So our government needs to focus on educating people about climate change, educating the business community about what can be done and what they're willing to, you know, assist them with, and make sure we foster an environment where people understand these things but still have the free will to change the things as they feel they need to be changed. Again, I think America does a very good job already of, you know, producing clean energy and, you know, being on, you know, the edge of the next technological revolution when it comes to these type of technologies. But we also need to make sure we're holding the rest of the world accountable, because at the end of the day, America can do everything at once. We can go to zero emissions, whatever the case is, but if every other country around the world is not in step with us and still producing mass emissions like places like China, it really won't matter at the end of the day. So I just think we need to do a better job of education. I'm definitely not against, you know, finding cleaner energies and, you know, promoting and educating people on cleaner energies, but we need to make sure we're holding everybody accountable and doing it the right way, where we're not just picking winners and losers, but we're keeping it a competitive environment and we're giving people the educational tools they need to make the best decisions to make, you know, the best products.
Now, at the COP26 climate conference in Scotland, Biden apologized for the Trump administration's pullout from the Paris Climate Accords. He said, quote, "I guess I shouldn't apologize, but I do apologize." Was that the right move by the president?
Well, of course not. And to that, I apologize to the rest of the world that half of this country actually put somebody like Biden in the White House. This is a guy that fell asleep yesterday at the G20 summit. I mean, this guy, for him to talk about anybody, any type of way in a negative light, when you're falling asleep at the summit, when you're aimlessly walking around the stage while your wife is giving a speech and literally walking off the stage aimlessly, he doesn't really have much room to say anything about anybody. If anything, we figured out that Trump was exactly right with what he said and the reasons why he wanted to get out the Paris Climate Accord, because we see places like China not being held to the same standard, not, you know, doing the same things that we would have been required to do. And they would have just been eating our lunch like we did with NAFTA and other things. So, you know, he was absolutely right as far as President Trump to actually get out of that deal. President Biden was absolutely wrong to actually say something of that. But again, we're not surprised, man. We're not surprised at all. This is a party that just really just thinks they hold some type of moral authority over people when we know that they don't. And I think Biden was the perfect vessel to put in there to actually show people from all parties, from all walks of life, that, you know, it is just that. And these guys do not have the moral authority. And in fact, they're pretty much too incompetent to do half the job that the last administration did, as we see everything going backwards, whether it's gas prices, food prices, Afghanistan. I mean, I just saw a report yesterday saying that ISIS will now have the capability to strike America within the next 6 months. And 6 months after that, Al-Qaeda will have the same capabilities because of what this disastrous administration left behind and didn't do in places like Afghanistan. So he doesn't really have much room to say anything about anybody, but we also know that he's going to continue to do that. So Trump made the right decision. The rest of the world needs to get on board. And if for some reason we're ever to enter an agreement like that, we need to make sure that the rest of the world is being held accountable for what they're doing, because by all means right now, and what we see, America is still doing what they would have been required to do in that Paris Climate Accord, because our business community, our citizens are that in tune with what's going on, and we're just that free of a people that we automatically make these decisions to get things right, you know, initially without being pushed in agreements like that to actually do it. So I'm proud of this country. I'm proud of the citizens of it. I'm proud of the business community here and what they've already done, and we need to make sure, again, if we do enter into another agreement like that, there's much more rules, regulations, and oversight on the other countries as opposed to America, who's already doing the job that these other countries should be doing.
I want to switch gears here and talk about what's going on in Congress right now. They're debating the Biden infrastructure and Build Back Better plan in Washington. If you were in Congress right now, would you vote for this?
The Build Back Better plan, I would not vote for at all. I think that's just another laundry list of what we've been talking about as far as climate change and the different ways they want to strategically, change our energy apparatus and our business community out here. So absolutely not. As far as the bipartisan bill, I believe it was a $550 billion deal where it directly related to the, you know, infrastructure as far as bridges, our airports, our bridges and things like that. I actually do support that. From what I've seen so far, that was just a much more classic take on our infrastructure, which was the right take to actually have on this, because we've all been talking about our bridges, our airports, our water systems and all that for a long time, whether it's what happened in Flint, Michigan with the water or the bridges in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We definitely know we need to fix our real infrastructure. When it comes to this social infrastructure that they're talking about in the Build Back Better plan, absolutely not, and that needs to be taken out on its own and voted for on its own, so we can see exactly where people stand. So half that bill I do, but the Build Back Better plan, I would absolutely not vote for that. That would be a no vote for me.
Now, some members of Congress, including some from New Jersey, in fact, say SALT needs to be included in this. The elimination of the state and local tax deduction has hit New Jerseyans pretty hard. Do you agree with this?
SALT is something that I know a lot of New Jerseyans, not just Democrats and not just Republicans, but all New Jerseyans actually really appreciate it and do want. So as far as the SALT deduction, I actually am a proponent of the SALT deduction, especially, you know, being a homeowner out here myself and things of that sort. We absolutely need to be able to deduct those taxes, especially when we're already the highest tax state in the country. But New Jerseyans, when it comes to taxes, as of right now, need all the relief they can get, and I would be a proponent for the SALT deduction to be included.
Now, I want to switch gears here and talk about a trip that you just came back from. You were just at the southern border in Texas. What's it like down there?
Man, it was just, this is my second time. I've actually been in the border in the last 6 months more times than Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have combined, which is sad to say, and I never thought I'd actually be able to say that with a straight face, but it's the truth. And, you know, this was actually even more in-depth than the trip that I went through the first time in El Paso, because we decided to, first of all, the reason for going out there was the group Veterans for America First was going out there to lock arms at the actual border wall in solidarity because of a whistleblower that just blew the whistle that as of yesterday, there was a directive by the Biden administration that if you were not vaccinated as a Border Patrol agent, you would be fired. So we were going down there to stand in solidarity with them and lock arms on the border. And it was a great experience. As always, we got to meet a lot of great people, a lot of candidates came down there that are running for Congress next year. But the most eye-opening thing was this was the first time I actually got to see people illegally crossing. And at night, myself, another congressional candidate, Billy Prempe, a couple other people, decided to get in the car and go down all the way to the border, all the way to the most dangerous wall we could actually find. And what we found when we got there was the first thing we saw was a couple on a back dirt road standing, not a couple, I'm sorry, a family standing on a back dirt road, about five or six of them waiting across. When they saw our light, they kind of froze up and they stood there, but we pulled up to them. And, you know, a lot of people told us it was dangerous and we shouldn't do those things, but we're from Jersey. So we just go, man. It is what it is. And I pulled up on side of them, you know, said, "Como está?" One of the girls in there spoke Spanish and they told us, yeah, they were crossing over and just trying to get to America. So once we left them, we kind of turned back around, went back the other way. That is when we saw about 50 to 70 people crossing our border illegally in droves. We saw a Border Patrol agent actually come over, and the crazy thing is they didn't arrest them. I don't know if that's because we didn't get a chance to ask them, but I assume that has something to do with the Biden administration's policy on how they are to handle people like this. But we saw him just pointing people in a direction. So we actually pulled up on a large group of them, and we asked them in Spanish what was going on. They said Border Patrol had directed them to a compound that they can go to within our country. We also saw a little girl at the front of the line walking with no shoes. They told us that they had walked from Nicaragua and Guatemala. That's what they told us. We're not sure if that's the case, but they told us they walked all the way from Nicaragua and Guatemala. So one of the ladies in the van felt so bad, she actually took off her shoes and gave it to the young lady right there, because it was just so heartbreaking to see. So to the Biden administration, listen, I'm not for illegal immigration. Republicans, conservatives, and a lot of American citizens aren't for illegal immigration, but Part of the reason why we need to make sure we're enforcing our border laws, we need to make sure we have enough Border Patrol agents, we need to make sure we finish the wall on that, is so people aren't tempted to make this journey and risk their lives and really just end up in some really bad conditions. As we were walking there, you saw people with poop stains in their pants, pee stains in their pants. Like, these people are literally just walking, defecating, and using the bathrooms on themselves because of this journey, because they want to get here so bad because of an administration that basically told them they would have carte blanche to do so, even though now they're being forced to change their tune and the federal judge has now told them that they need to reinstate the stay in Mexico policy. Before all that happened, this was an administration that actually encouraged these people to come up here through their rhetoric, and it's not right. And they literally and directly put tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's lives in danger because of the lies that they have spewed, because of the direction they have decided to go, where they're just blankly calling people racist for wanting to enforce our immigration laws when that's not actually the case. So if you, going forward as a candidate in this country, if you cannot unequivocally state that we need to secure our border and that has to be done, you do not even deserve to be able to run for office in this country, because it was that bad. And I was not expecting to see that. But when we turned that corner and saw 50 to 70 people walking down there with backpacks on, holding infants, all dirty with no shoes on, man, it was just heartbreaking and indicative of how incompetent this administration really is and how bad the problem really is.
Now, I know you got to get going, but I have one more thing I just got to ask you about. The FDA has given emergency authorization to the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11. I know you're not a big fan of the COVID vaccine mandates. Will schools require students take the vaccine in order to go to class now that's available to most of them, in your view?
Well, I think it's going to come down from state to state. I don't think the federal government will get involved in that, but I think it's going to come from state to state. But if you go to places like New York, you go to places like California, you go to some of these other Democratic Michigan and places like that, I think it's a real possibility right now that those governors and those legislators will actually try to institute those things. And you're going to see a lot more pushback as far as that as well. That's why you have so many people running for school board, for city council, just local offices, because it's time for us to take, you know, our city back and our schools back and our children's educations back. You know, again, as we spoke about before, we understand that it is harder for kids to actually, you know, transmit and catch this virus in a lot of cases. And that's not to say that they can't, but if we're looking at the actual science, that is the science right now, right? Kids, young kids especially, are not dying from these diseases. So we need to have some nuance in the approaches that we take. So somebody like myself, I had COVID back in November. I have antibodies. We see reports out of Israel coming out now, basically saying that if you have natural immunity, in some cases you're either just as efficient or 27 times more effective and efficient than somebody that has a vaccine you know, vaccine immunity to this. So, you know, we need to start following the science. We need to start looking at these things. And in states that believe in people's free will, states that believe in freedom, believe in the American way, they need to start recognizing the nuances of things. Nobody's saying that you can't promote the vaccine and you can't encourage people to get that. I don't care if you take the vaccine or you don't. If you want to take it and you've talked to your family and your doctor and that's a decision, great. But if you have reasons for not taking it, I think they should be heard, like they always have. You know, we talk about the measles and the mumps, but guess what? If you had the measles and the mumps, you never were required to take those vaccinations because you had some type of immunity from having those things. So I think these governors, these legislators need to have a little bit more heart, look at a lot more of the nuances of what's happening and not just blanketly telling people they need to do this, this, and that, and mandating these things, because you're really driving a wedge between the people and our government. You're driving a wedge between people in different communities within their own communities, and it's not a good thing. And if we keep going this way, it's not going to end up being a good thing either. So I think as Republicans take over states like Virginia and New Jersey, no, we will not have those mandates. But unfortunately, I'm afraid that some of these states absolutely will have these mandates, and I don't think it will end well.
Republican congressional candidate for New Jersey's 12th District, Darius Mayfield, thank you so much for taking the time for us today. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Joey. I look forward to coming back on with you again, brother.
Governor Murphy has been projected to win what is quite historic, a second term for office, which for a Democrat governor, that doesn't really happen too much. It hasn't been done since 1977. When Brendan Byrne did it, and he got reelected. Incumbent Democratic governors don't typically get that. So he's been projected to get the win there. Despite former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli, he's put up quite up the fight. He outperformed every expectation. Polling didn't have him anywhere near this. The best one was Trafalgar, where they had him around 4 points. And that was taken just before the election, like days before. And besides from that, nothing even predicted this would be anywhere close at all. Now, at the time of this recording, Cittarelli has not conceded the race. Here to break it down for us are former Rutgers Republican chairman and former intern for the 2017 Jack Cittarelli campaign, Robbie Soriano, and our Middlesex County Revolution founder, John Sue. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this race. Now, this race has been called for Governor Murphy, but not by nearly the margins that all the pollsters were saying. It was predicted to either be, if you're looking at the Monmouth poll, like a blowout with Murphy double digits, or if you even look at Trafalgar, which was probably the tightest margin, Murphy was supposed to be up plus four, but that wasn't the case. So, John, what do you make of this being so close?
Well, I think Republicans have a tendency to underpoll, and we've seen that in the Trump election. And so I think it's a continuation of that. We also see that the results, actually, the Democrats came out in the same numbers as similar to 2017. So there was a strong anti-Murphy sentiment, I think. The Republicans came out in force. We saw that locally. I'm from Middlesex County. We saw that locally in places like Old Bridge, Milltown, where the Republicans swept through the council races, and the turnout was 20 to 30% higher than the previous governor's year. So definitely, there's a strong Murphy anti-Murphy sentiment, and it definitely drove out the turnout.
Robbie, you worked with Cittarelli's previous campaign and know some people who are working for him now. Did the Cittarelli campaign see this coming?
I think so. If you spend time like me wasting your time on Twitter, you saw Cittarelli campaign folks hit back hard on the Monmouth poll, even going so far as calling it voter suppression. And they claimed in their that their internal polling had it as a much, much closer race. And at the time, and I'll be honest with you, I thought, well, that's just campaigning. You know, you're not going to concede, yeah, we're down 10 points a week to go, But now it turns out that they had it spot on. I think it probably did catch the Murphy campaign a little flat-footed. I don't think they were expecting it to be this close. And I think it's ultimately a it's probably a referendum on the Biden administration, and he isn't that popular right now. And I also think it shows that the Republican Party can make up ground lost in the suburban areas in the Trump era. Murphy, if you could define the Murphy campaign in one thing, it would be tying Jack Vittorelli to Donald Trump. And I don't think he laid a hand on him in that respect. I don't think the voters are buying it. I think the voters are perfectly willing to separate their personal dislike of Donald Trump and the Republican Party. So that is something Democrats probably have to think about going into next year, that it might not be particularly effective to tie otherwise normal milquetoast Republicans with Donald Trump.
John, I mean, going off what Robbie was saying and what you just said earlier about the fact that Republicans have been underestimated before. You look at 2016, where Trump won states where he wasn't even predicted to win, or he was in narrow margins of winning states that no one ever thought possible because Republicans weren't being honest with the votes here. And you look at the polls now, and you look at things that are very popular amongst New Jerseyans. Governor Murphy has high marks for his COVID response. Supposedly, the residents' majorities had, the majority of New Jersey residents believe that the mask mandates are appropriate, even the ones in schools, and vaccine mandates are also popular. So why did the polls get this so wrong?
Oh, well, I think one thing is COVID, as the importance of COVID has slowly dropped as time has gone on. And we can see it in the how things are starting to open a little bit more in New Jersey. And actually, you know, you kind of notice it in the social circles that people are getting a little bit more relaxed with COVID. But in terms of the polling, I think part of it, like I said, the Democrats did not come out in bigger numbers than 2017. In fact, the 1.2 million votes is almost equal to the 1.2 million that Murphy got in 2017. So there is a disappointment with the Democratic Party nationally. So you can see that that the Build Back Better plan is not getting any traction, of whether it's because of Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema. So Joe Biden, as a result, Joe Biden looks ineffective as a leader. There was a lot of promises made, such as $15 minimum wage, which is extremely popular throughout the country. Even in Florida, they passed a referendum to pass $15 minimum wage. So he did not get that passed. They were expecting more in terms of bailouts. The bailout could have been a lot better. A lot of small businesses suffered because of the type of bailout that the national government delivered. If you look at other countries, like their support for the working class was much better. Like European countries, Canada, what have you. They would just provide 80% of the salary. Sometimes it'd be a monthly check. $1,000, $2,000, something like that. So we can say there's a lot of disappointment with the Biden campaign, Biden administration so far. So I think that is keeping the Democratic support level. It's not necessarily exciting the base right now. And at the same time, there's a lot of anti-Biden sentiment, and that an anti-Murphy sentiment, and that's bringing out the base of the Republican Party.
Robbie, with this whole underpolling thing, is it to the race's detriment that we didn't know this earlier on, that Chitarelli was surging in a way that is different from past Republican candidates?
Yeah, I think it certainly did a disservice to New Jersey voters. But perhaps it did a it was to Chitarelli's advantage. As previously mentioned, the Republicans came out and voted, and independents broke for Republicans. The Democrats, on the other hand, while it wasn't low turnout, particularly for a gubernatorial race, it was less enthusiastic. If it was known that this is a close race, it could have enthused both sides. And the tough fact for Republicans in New Jersey are there is physically more Democrats in New Jersey than there are Republicans. So it might have done a disservice. You know, it's a counterfactual. We don't know how it would have worked. It could have been, it could have energized Republicans more, gotten more people to vote out. But on the same token, it could have gotten more Democrats out. So it is tough to say, but certainly the national press would have been a lot more interested in New Jersey. It was somewhat funny last night where everyone was focused on Virginia. Everyone thought Virginia is going to go deep into the night watching. And within an hour or so, it became clear how that race was going. And people looked in New Jersey and were like, who is this Jack Chitarelli guy? And why is he leaving? So it was funny to see, but it's tough to say how that would have affected things.
John, should this be a lesson to the state pollsters?
Oh, I think most people are expecting Republicans to be undercounted in these past elections. You know, I think that's just part of the equation now going forward. There seems to be a general distrust of polling and a general disinterest. Just anecdotally, I just seen it among Republican friends, and yeah, people get mad about like pollsters calling them. So you know that could be part of it. But polling is always, I think, is always important. Just it's a general indicator of how things are going. I do find it interesting that Chitarelli's internal polls have had the race a lot closer. Perhaps the Republican voters were more willing to talk to his campaign. I think polling is always kind of a useful tool, at least somewhat of a barometer of where things are going.
I want to bring up the fact that with the polling general, it just seemed like a race that was just underpolled. I mean, with the Virginia race Robbie was talking about, there's a lot of natural interest in that. And the reason why is because there was a poll coming out almost every day on this thing ever since September, where in New Jersey, there really wasn't much polling happening until the final weeks. And even then, there wasn't that much. There really was no national pollsters. It was Rutgers did a couple polls, Fairleigh Dickinson. Monmouth was the most consistent here. Robbie, do elections in the state of New Jersey need to be better polled going forward?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly you get more out of polling in general when there's more of it, because you can put it into an average and you can see trends. Individual polls, you know, it's tough to tell. But in the take, for example, the Virginia race, you could see the trend line very clearly. It was getting closer and closer. And in the final days, Youngkin surpassed in the polling average his opponent. So you certainly get a better sense of where things are. And if it's under polls, you know, you're just basing movement from former polls or not movement, sometimes months later, and it's tough to get any sense of where the race actually is. And it is a problem. And I think people, and the more they poll New Jersey, the better they'll understand the quirks of, you know, the electorate. If, you know, you just come in and every 4 years and do two polls, you're not going to get much understanding. But if you do it a lot, you'll understand it more. But it is, to defend the pollsters, I suppose, which I'm not want to do, you know, New Jersey is a boring state. We're not a swing state. You know, the only interesting races are the governor's races. And the last interesting one was 12 years ago with Chris Christie, because it was clear Christie was getting reelected, and then it was clear Phil Murphy was getting elected. And I suppose they thought it was clear Phil Murphy was going to get reelected. So why put your limited resources into New Jersey? So that being said, I agree definitely New Jersey warrants more polls.
Chitterelli clearly outperformed expectations here. John, you brought up the fact that turnout in Middlesex County, in particular Old Bridge and Milltown, they were up 25%. How did Chitterelli do this geographically? Was it mainly in the suburbs? Was it going into more liberal territory and bringing out, or is it just simply running it up in places where Republicans typically do well anyways?
Yeah, so I could just talk about Old Bridge real quick. I was a campaign manager, actually, for one of the council races there. But Chitterelli came to Old Bridge four times, and he did rallies where he kind of interacted more with the people, with the local people. As for Murphy, he did like big rallies. He brought in big names such as Jill Biden. He brought in Bernie Sanders towards the end. Cal Penn, the actor. So he did a couple of these big rallies to try to bring up excitement. But Jack did some smaller rallies. He, you know, he met with people in restaurants, in small stores, and that way it was a. And he did that more often. So that kind of saw that build excitement there. So definitely he was definitely in the suburbs, interacting with a Republican base that was mostly that doesn't always come out to vote, and that definitely helped drive turnout there.
Despite Murphy underperforming expectations, Democratic governors typically are a shoo-in for a loss when it comes to New Jersey ever since 1977. But Murphy pulled it out; he won. Robbie, what did he do well in order to get to this point that other governors, Florio, McGreevy, and Corzine, just simply couldn't do?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of going into the race, he still was relatively popular. He was still supported, especially on COVID. I mentioned earlier, he couldn't get a glove on Jack over tying him to Trump, but Jack really couldn't get a glove on him with the COVID stuff. It certainly rallied the Republican base, but I think the average person generally gave Murphy, he did fine. They would accept the nursing home policy was a mistake, but also say that was early on, and you got to give flack early on during an unprecedented crisis. So he came in relatively strong, and what he needed to do was not run a good campaign, not necessarily run a good campaign, just not run a bad campaign. And he ran a campaign. It wasn't a world-beating campaign, but it was not a bad campaign. I keep comparing the two, but they are the two things that have gone on. The Democrat in Virginia ran a bad campaign. he was reacting to the Republican candidate. He got hit hard on some things he said about parents and their kids' education, and that's an issue close to parents. And if you look at the polls, parents voted against him. Governor Murphy got hit hard for his line, if taxes are your issue, we're not your state. And I'm sure that helped Jack, but that's only to a point because people know Bill Murphy's not a tax cutter. They know that. That's baked into the pie. So it can only hit you so much. And if people already gave him good marks, knowing he's sort of a high tax guy, they're not going to, that's not going to kill him. It wasn't some new revelation. So ultimately, he ran a perfectly decent campaign, and that's all you need to do as an incumbent. Don't blow it up, and he didn't blow it up. And I think even with the national headwinds against him, he prevented more of a swing.
Now, history tends to favor Republican challengers when going up against incumbent Democratic governors, as I mentioned previously, but Chitarelli has clearly faced an uphill battle this whole campaign. I mean, John, why is that Chitarelli just wasn't able to close this gap and it be the other way around where he's the one who narrowly won?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think he outperformed the expectations. So I think that was a strong showing. I actually kind of think the premise is of the question is I don't quite agree with it. I think Chitarelli really did well. I think that tax comment that Murphy made really hurt him. Unfortunately, that did not get enough play, I don't think, around the state. If that did get more play, I think that could have helped Chitarelli. My understanding is that Chitarelli had to get his name out early in the campaign, so he had to spend a little bit more money early on to increase his name recognition. So I think perhaps that towards the end he lacked the funds to make the final push in order to make up that gap. But yeah, he was close. Like it is really close. One number I see is 1.2 million against 1.199 million. So it was a very close race. I'll just say one thing about Murphy. You know, I think he did run an okay campaign. A couple of things that the establishment Democrats in New Jersey are trying to do is pin the close campaign on the progressives. Like because Murphy had Bernie Sanders on for the last week of the campaign, that perhaps that was the reason why the race was so close. And I just want to point out that I don't think that's the case. I think that final push actually helped Murphy get a couple thousand votes. There was so much excitement at Rutgers. I was there at the rally. But there was so much excitement at Rutgers to see Bernie campaign for Murphy, I'm very sure that thousands of students would not have voted if Bernie did not come out for Murphy on that last week. On that last week, you can just see it. You can just sense the excitement. You can hear the crowd roaring. We only had one day to promote the event. And about 1,000 people came out. I'm sure we would have had a couple thousand if we had a couple more days to promote the event, to let people know what was happening. I just want to say that, you know, the establishment Democrats are definitely going to try to pin this on the progressives, and that's just not the case. And if anything, it helped out a little bit at the end. I think Chitarelli ran a decent campaign and really did narrow the margin.
Now, Murphy was leading in the polls the entire race. This entire race, Chitarelli was never in it. We've discussed this several times. But the question is, why did it come to this point? I mean, what was that thing of how Murphy blew this thing, in a sense? Even though he did win, yes, he did win, but how did that thing shrink? I mean, Robbie, was it the fact that there were big rallies rather than Chitterelli that was more small town going up shaking hands with people? Was it the debates where Murphy wasn't doing so hot, according to many people, whether it was putting the chapstick on or making the faces or trying to pin Trump to Chitterelli and then Chitterelli having some witty comebacks? I mean, how did Murphy lose this support?
Well, I think certainly Murphy comes off as aloof. He was a hedge fund guy, very wealthy, you know, ambassador to Germany. Not an everyday, you know, sort of workaday guy, versus Jack, who was, you know, he was a humble accountant. You can certainly, if you send them both into a diner to schmooze a diner full of New Jerseyans, Cinderella will come out on top of that. But I think it would be naive to put it all on, you know, aloofness or personability. I think it's just Joe Biden is unpopular. I mean, it is common. It is almost inevitable in American politics that the election after one party wins the White House and in the midterms, the other party is going to do well. It's a combination of, you know, it's one thing to run a campaign, it's another thing to lead a nation. And the opposing party, their base is pissed off that they lost and want to go out there and vote. So it's just an inevitability. I think Joe Biden has his first year, or a little under a year in the White House, has been mismanaged. I think he certainly misread his mandate. He was elected in a very close election. He was given a 50-50 Senate. He really should have been given a minority in the Senate. If his opponent didn't try the big brain strategy of telling his base it's rigged, so don't vote, he really should have not had those two extra senators, but he does. So he has a tie Senate and a slim House majority. His mandate was simple: manage COVID and not be Donald Trump. But he took that election to mean his mandate was to be FDR and do big, huge things. And I just think that's a misread of what the American people wanted. I think the American people wanted a return to normalcy and a return to competency. And I think a lot of it is that illusion of competency was broken with Afghanistan. I think the complete mismanagement of the withdrawal from Afghanistan really opened a lot of people's eyes that Joe Biden, he was always somewhat, had a screw loose, if you will. And now he's getting up there with old. I'm not suggesting, you know, he's sick. I'm just suggesting he's old. Would you put your grandpa in charge of the country? Probably not. So that sort of hurt them. And I think that's why these elections are so close. Joe Biden and natural American politics.
All right, well, we'll have to leave it there. Former 2017 Jack Chitterelli campaign intern Robbie Soriano and our Middlesex County Revolution founder, John Sue. Thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me, as always, to keep up with what's going on the show. All you have to do is follow me on social media. You can do that on Twitter, which is @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. And you can also check me out on Instagram, which is @joey.block.39. Again, that is @joey.block.39. And in order to make sure you catch every single episode, all you have to do is, you know, usually it's around Fridays at 12 o'clock at noon. We've been keeping pretty good at that. So around that time, what you're going to want to do is you're going to go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com. You're going to go to the podcast section. That'll be on the left-hand side of the screen. Just press that podcast button, and you're going to look for In the Middle with Joey Block. You'll see me, and the latest episode should be at the top of the page, and then you can catch all the past episodes there in case you happen to miss one. Well, thank you so much for listening. This has been In the Middle, and I'm Joey Block. We'll be back again next week right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.